I told a repo man, my 920's gonna take me far today. You can travel for miles and never leave L.A.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is coming to the City Winery tomorrow night in the West Loop for the final performance of a summer residency.
Woohoo!
Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter Michelle Schacht will be performing her 1992 album Arkansas Traveler tomorrow night. That album, along with 1989's Captain Swing and 1988's Short, Sharp, Schacht, make up the Grammy-nominated trilogy and made Michelle Schacht a household name in folk. Although Schacht shows up in a category called anti-folk, a movement of musicians who may sound the part, but their music pushes back against the mainstream idea of folk music. Think 60s hippies, free love, etc. Michelle Schacht lives up to her name. She's been a controversial figure in American music for years. Even this record, Arkansas Traveler, the one she's playing at City Winery, was a source of contention back in the day because of her choice for cover art. But through the years, Michelle Schacht has both entertained us and challenged us with her views on politics, religion, and sexuality, and she shows no signs of slowing down. And she's in the midst of a tour that had her in Scotland earlier this month at the Fringe and Nashville later this week. But tomorrow, she's at the City Winery here in Chicago in the West Loop, and she is my guest tonight at the big table, Michelle Schacht. Nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Justin. It's a pleasure. Our paths have finally crossed.
I was thinking the same thing. When are our paths going to cross? All right, so I love the idea of the trilogy of playing full albums. I mean, this is the 25th anniversary of Arkansas Traveler. When you do these kind of shows, do you go back to who you were 25 years ago? How do you approach re-examining a full album that you produced 25 years ago?
There's a very unique aspect to the Mercury trilogy that you won't find in the typical retrospective of an artist going back and revisiting their canon. And it's a subtle difference, but I hope you can appreciate what it is. When I signed the contract with Mercury Records in 1987, I had the benefit of a successful bootleg called the Texas Campfire Tapes. It was kind of like the wind behind my back. And so I was one of the few artists I knew who said, hey, I didn't ask for this job, okay? You came looking for me, and here's my terms. I did not get into this to be a career girl, an artist. My real goal was to be a political activist. And so I told him, you know what? I don't want your advance. I don't want those, I think at the time it was like $100,000, $200,000 advance. I said, keep your chump change, because really what that is, they're loaning you
own money. It's actually smart to think that way.
See, you're following this. And so I said, you know what I want? I want the masters. I want to own the masters. So when I go out now and I perform Arkansas Traveler or Short Sharp Shock or Captain Swing, it is literally the pride of ownership, knowing that it is, you know, my little 40 acres that I can just harvest whatever I choose. So it gives me a luxury.
We'll get into it too about Mercury Records, but that's very ahead of your time.
See?
To think that way, was that something at the time that came from who you were, the people around you? Where did the idea that the ownership of your music was more important than the stardom?
It was a very narrow window of time when, remember, the Dead Kennedys had started Alternative Tentacles, right? So we kind of got the memo. It's like those guys aren't your friends. I couldn't quite fill in the dots. I didn't know why they weren't my friends. I just knew they weren't my friends. And then there was also the folk side of things, where a Texas folk singer named Nancy Griffith told me, at the time they were saying own your publishing, but I took it one step further.
Masters,
and wanted
right.
to own the master recordings.
Because that is kind of unheard of, because you'll always be able to get the publishing rights, right? I mean, that's something they say, you can own the song, but we'll own what you recorded in our studio. So, I mean, there is something to be said about that. That must have been something that might have been a head scratcher for Mercury at the time. Did they give it up lightly?
No. It's one thing to negotiate a right, sort of like freedom of speech. It's like you've got the freedom, not try exercising it. And that's when you really push comes to shove. And so what happened was, as long as they had me on the label, they had control of the masters. And the minute that the contract was over, the master rights came back to me. So guess what they did? They wouldn't let me leave the label, but they wouldn't let me record. For almost 6 years, they had me on ice. And so what I had to do eventually was sue them for violating my, here's your U.S. constitutional history, see if you know this, violating my 13th Amendment.
Oh, I don't know the 13th Amendment.
That's right. It's not the one that gave women the right to vote. It was the one that abolished slavery. They basically had me in a slave contract.
You used that?
I did.
You used that amendment?
That was it, the 13th Amendment.
And it worked.
Well, the day before it was supposed to go to court, it was like Pharaoh to Moses, like, take your masters and go. So now I was free to go. But as you mentioned, you know, there's been a lot of times where I was pushing back against the corporate label system. So I got caught back in 92 in a controversy having to do with Arkansas Traveler. So it's a lot of fun to revisit that controversy now.
How does all of that, and the idea of the fight for the soul of your music, for the stuff that you recorded, how does that affect what we're going to see tomorrow? I mean, do you feel more connected to the music because you own it?
Well, you were asking earlier, like, what does it feel like to go back in time?
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like that. What it is like I've always had that long view in mind. I mean, the long game was really all I had going for me, because when they put me on ice, they basically took me in a back room and said, this label's never going to promote you properly because you cut too good a deal for yourself. Now, we'd like to believe that art is based on its own merits. If it's great art, it'll find its audience. And I think Arkansas Traveler, in fact, became a word of mouth album. Mm-hmm. But in many respects, it was in spite of. There was a blacklisting. I can't, you know, point to the specifics of it, but there was a blacklisting. So now to be doing it, it's is a freaking victory lap. That's what it is. I win.
I love it. Michelle Schacht in studio. She's playing the Arkansas Traveler record in entirety tomorrow at City Winery in the West Loop on Randolph Street. All right, here's what we'll do. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk more. Michelle Schacht, my guest tonight at the big table. Stay with us.
What's to be done with a prodigal son? Welcome him home with open arms. Throw a big party, invite your friends. Our boys come back home.
Music from Michelle Schacht, Prodigal Daughter, is the name of the song. Michelle Schacht is in Chicago. She is playing the City Winery in the West Loop on Randolph Street. Tomorrow night, she's playing the entire record, Arkansas Traveler. This is part of a trilogy of the record. She's been doing this all summer, not just here, but in New York, Atlanta, other places where there's City Wineries where you're playing all three records in their entirety tonight. Or tomorrow night will be the finale for Chicago with Arkansas Traveler. Arkansas Traveler, it's amazing to think it's been 25 years to that record. You know, when we talk about that and we kind of talk about the controversy, that what I always loved about your music and re-experienced it today listening to a lot of different stuff is that you went out of your way to almost change the theme, tone, style of your music record by record. And, you know, the first one was a little bit more sort of folk, and the second one was swing. The third one really was a throwback to American music and what you wanted to do with the cover is you wanted it to be in blackface on the front of the cover, because this was sort of almost a shout out to minstrel music or throwback to some of the days of vaudeville and the music that was produced. That didn't sit well with the record company, with the record label, management, everybody involved. They didn't want you to express yourself that way on the record.
Well, let me bifurcate that question. There's two parts to it. One is that when I signed the contract with Mercury, it was the year of the woman, right? Okay, let's review. There was Suzanne Vega, Tracy Chapman, Sinead O'Connor. I'm like, no, I am not doing this to be like, you know, chick music. I've got much bigger fish to fry. Thank you. And so what I told him was, I can't tell you where I'm going as an artist. I'm still kind of in a formative stage. But what I can do is tell you where I've come from. So mm-hmm. when I was in New York, I was at that club CBGB's.
Yeah.
Do you know what CBGB stands for?
What it stands for? No, I know the club, but no.
That's a trick question. It stands for country, bluegrass, blues. Remember where you heard it first. And so what I realize is that my musical influence is my background. I come from Texas, and it's got that, you know, rich diversity. We don't call it folk music there. We call it picker poet music.
Right.
So that was what Short, Sharp, Shocked was. But I followed that up with a big band blues swing album, because that is as much a part of what Texas music is, you know? And then to follow that with a bluegrass album, it wasn't for the sake of doing different things.
Right.
It was to say...
It followed a path that who you were. Right.
I always thought of it like a breadcrumb trail. Like, I knew that I was going to be kind of going down these adventurous... But I wanted to figure out how to get back home. So by leaving this breadcrumb trail of those influences, I say, well, that's where I came from. And so... Obviously, that was a challenge for the marketing department of the label, but to my credit, I had told... I'll give you an example. On Arkansas Traveler, there's a song called The Secret to a Long Life is Knowing When It's Time to Go. And the A&R guy that signed me, he says, you should put that on Short, Sharp, Shocked. I said, no, that's going on Arkansas Traveler. So again, an example of kind of a foresightedness. Now let's go to the cover of Arkansas Traveler and what I was trying to do with the theme. When I originally conceived of Arkansas Traveler, it was a pretty simple concept. My dad had taught himself how to play mandolin from a book when he was 35 years old. And so me and my brother were watching him, and he's, you know, he loves music, but it was such an inspiration for us to go, well, if he can do it, you know. So my brother, you know, was eventually in Wilco. Back in the days, went from Uncle Tupelo to Wilco, and I made that introduction. I was, you know, very fortunate to have that love of songwriting that took me places. And so I just took original lyrics and put them to these traditional fiddle tunes. That's all I was really planning to do with Arkansas Traveler. And then I fell in love. And the journalist that I fell in love with was so deeply researched and knowledgeable about the real history of American music that we describe American music as having been, you know, we gave birth to the blues, we gave birth to jazz, right? Mm. In order for us to maintain that story, we have to erase about 60 to 80 years of American musical history that is very inconvenient. And, okay, we're going to go there. See if you can follow where my logic is going.
I'm following you, yeah.
The best take I heard about Charlottesville was to say, since when do we... remove the evidence from the scene of the crime? You know, since when is that a good idea? And we also know the saying about those who do not know their history are forever
doomed to repeat it,
condemned to repeat it. So there is a very strong justification for keeping this history intact. But in the case of blackface minstrelsy, it was such an inconvenient truth that it would be repeatedly ripped out of history books, ripped out of music.
Because history. Of the shame and the idea of everything that went into it. So there's a way that we're, no pun intended, whitewashing history to say that, no, this never happened.
And it eliminates the possibility. And this is what my now ex-husband's research confirmed without a shadow of a doubt, is that that history had much more complexity to it than just the simplified racist shame, that there was transformative elements that performers in blackface, both African-American and white performers, would be in this, and the transformations that would take place in those roles. It's a complicated history,
yeah.
See?
But there's no doubt putting yourself in blackface and putting on the front of an album in 1992 is, I mean, time is as important to history as anything. And the time and place of that, at where we were at that point, 1992, it was not the right place to do that. I mean, I don't think anyone would argue that that would probably be the right thing to do.
Well, here's the alternative. The alternative is that you had white record executives wearing entire black people as fronts, as you know, they were, okay, here's my biggest. So you got these white label executives signing and promoting gangster rap. Now, at the time...
We just saw it in Defiant once, which was an HBO.
Yeah,
that's what you're talking about. Yeah,
okay, so what you had is they were selling this music, by and large, to white suburban kids as the authentic ghetto experience, right?
Right.
Straight out of Compton. Now, in 2008, 2009, in the subprime mortgage crisis, the crash of the market there, those neighborhoods were targeted for predatory loans by those suburban kids who had been raised on that music, believing that Compton was the depths of the ghetto, when in fact, Compton was the striving middle class, property value, you know, dad worked at the post office, mom was a teacher. It was real equity that they held onto, only to watch their kids turn around and sell the property value just for chump change.
So you see an ecosystem or a way in which some of the record executives and the way that they approached, and even going back and what happened with that music is similar to what happened in the vaudeville scene and what we talked about with the minstrel stuff. I mean, it's just been this way that history has kind of repeated itself over and over and over.
Thank you. Yeah, those kids grew up and became mortgage brokers. And the pattern just keeps repeating and repeating. So would you rather have profit, people making profit off of wearing, you know, holding up these sock puppet gangsta rap, whatever, or would you rather have the empowered performer speaking for themselves and having the choices to make to say, this is how I want to present myself? And that's only one half of the story. The other half of the story was, I am like from the deep East Texas roots. So the artificial divide between black and white music happened on that level as well. I'm, for all intents and purposes, an aw shucks hillbilly. So it happened on both sides. I didn't say that very well.
No, but you did. I'm fascinated by it. I mean, I think that there's truth to it, and I haven't heard too many artists talk about that. I mean, in a good and bad way, because I think that sometimes, you know, I feel like a good example would be, I listened to that music, but I didn't sell mortgages.
You grew up listening to gangster rap, right?
But that's what I'm saying. So you run into this idea that, you know, we typecast on every side. And so to say that everybody who listened to gangster rap turned up to be mortgage brokers.
That's not my point.
I know that's your point, but I'm just saying that, like, the idea that, you know, I understand where you're coming from, especially from the idea of history repeating itself.
Let me try to fine tune this in case I've
okay.
really dug you myself
know.
Into a
you're
hole.
You're good. You're good.
The commodity that's being sold is authenticity. That gangster rap
is right.
worthless if you believe that they're just putting on.
It's a movie CB4, but right.
But as long as you believe that it's the real deal, you know, hardcore ghetto story that they're telling.
I'm fascinated, and I want to take a break because I want to hit the news on time, but I'm fascinated because I find parallels to your career in the way that authenticity plays a huge part of Michelle Schock's whole character, even against what the record companies wanted you to be. I mean, to think about it, and the questions that popped into my mind, and we'll talk about it after the break, is this idea of, were you mislabeled? Or did they say, this is what Michelle Schock is to us, and we need her to stay there. And if she doesn't go, if she doesn't keep doing the Tracy Chapman, Suzanne Vega type stuff, she's not as valuable to us. You know, the conversation of what it means to be art, what it means to be commerce. Michelle Schocked in studio tonight. She is at City Winery in the West Loop. Tomorrow night she's playing the whole 1992 album, Arkansas Traveler, as part of the trilogy she's been performing all summer long. Michelle Schocked in studio. We'll take a break. We'll get an update onto news, and we'll continue the conversation. Stay with us.
I took time out to write to my old friend. I walked across that burning bridge. Mailed my letter off to Dallas, but her reply came from Anchorage, Alaska.
There's a song for you, Anchorage.
Signature song.
That's a signature. Michelle Schock, my guest tonight. Download The Big Table, Justin Kaufman. Michelle Schock, of course, at City Winery tomorrow night in West Loop, right there on Randolph. Great space. And she is playing the full album in its entirety of Arkansas Traveler. She has been doing this all summer long with all the trilogy from the 80s into the 90s. It's the 25th anniversary of Arkansas Traveler. We're having a outstanding conversation tonight just about authenticity. That's kind of where we were when we left before the news. And I feel all the things we were talking about, and we were talking about American music and all of the more kind of explorations and observations, but it all comes back to you in the way that I feel like you could replace a lot of the people you were just talking about in that conversation with yourself.
Yeah.
Because you were signed by Mercury, and like you said, sort of at the time when there were a lot of women singers that were coming up, Suzanne Vega, you mentioned Tracy Chapman, others, I'm thinking Indigo Girls were in that category around that time. And they wanted you to be a certain thing. Mm-hmm. And all of your career, you've almost been pushing back against that. I mean, when you find yourself in controversy, whether it be for talking on stage against a political issue, and everybody thinks you're one way, but you're the other, and in these different places, it's all pushing back almost to that very first idea of who your authentic self is.
Apparently. There is a time-honored tradition of this that we often, you know, relate to and appreciate about artists being, you know, quirky or idiosyncratic or whatever. But at the heart of it, there is this, it's as old as Greek mythology itself. There's this kind of trickster character where you, in minstrelsy, you remember the Uncle Remus story about the tar baby, is that there's this compulsive need to touch the sore spot, the thing that will, you know, I wonder if I touch this,
what happens, right?
And I don't do it for its own sake, but there is something, and I think I relate to it a lot with visual artists these days, that certain visual artists is like, you can't paint that, that's a soup can. And apparently someone like Andy Warhol was just like, his statement was, as an artist, was ha, 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 ha. Do you know why I'm bringing that up? Is that you can't manufacture that kind of authenticity. You either have that compulsion to touch the third rail, or you want to play nice and just kind of, like, be popular. And I don't know how I got to be like this.
Is it hard as an artist to continue to grow and develop and to honor what you've done in the past with the idea that you always want to touch the third rail? Meaning, you know, like people want to follow you and they want to be a part of your career, and far too often in time you're reaching out and you're, I want to touch that. You're zapping and you're ouch, you know, and then it changes who you are. I mean, is that difficult for you to sort of maintain a career where people follow you and want to be fans when you continue to have these sort of controversies around you?
It's a beautiful, poignant, soulful question. I'm going to try my best to answer it with the same respect that it deserves. And that is to say that all I can promise you is it's never done for the sake of controversy. It's done because I respect my instincts. And when you start out as an artist, you're as insecure as anyone. You want to be loved. You want to be nurtured. You want to be supported. And you get a lot of that. You get a lot of validation. People really pour a lot of appreciation into you to encourage you. Because I remember early on, I was like, what do I say? And they go, just be yourself. And I'm like, no, it can't be that easy. And then now I'm 30 years into it, and I don't know how to do anything. And the problem people have is now I really am good at being myself. And sometimes what that means is I'm left stranded out on a tide, and it's all left. And I'm there like, hey, where'd everybody go? And I respect myself enough now to the point where I'm not going to back down. And I have had that feeling the past 4 years where I'm literally like the only living boy in New York. I'm the only one left. Where'd everybody go? But it's always worth it. In the long run, the journey is always worth it.
You know, I think about your career and how you've pushed back, whether it be Mercury Records or just who you are and what category you've been put in. The idea of fighting. I mean, you always seem to be fighting against something. Is that hard? I mean, is it hard, like, when you think about your life and the idea that you're always pushing against the grain, you're trying to do something different? Is there time? Are there times when you feel like you're the only boy in New York City and you're like, you know what? I wish I didn't fight as much. Or I wish back in the day I would have taken the money instead of the masters. You know, I mean, do you think about that struggle?
I'm going to have to go into Sister Shocked mode. I'm sorry to do this. I know religion, politics, but yeah, I think there are people who are fighters, not by nature, but it's the thought I come to is the little shepherd with the slingshot going up against a giant named Goliath, and the entire army was trembling, and he's like, let me at him, you know. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. And later on, you know, in his career as king.
You're going deep cut. You know the whole story, right?
I'm really going deep. In his career as king, he was like, I want to do something for God. And God literally said, no, not you. You've shed too much blood. You've been a warrior. So I guess my appeal, and I doubt anybody's buying this line, but I'm going to make it anyways, is that I have a warrior heart. I'm just a girl, but I am a fighter, and I want to be loved like everybody mm-hmm. else, but there's something in me that says it's time to fight.
When, and that's such a good point in the way that changes happen in our politics, changes happen in our history, I mean, or how we view history. We're seeing this happen right now in our country. Even down to religion. I mean, religion, and you've had religion at the beginning of your life and even throughout, but now as well. The idea of time and place, and how does time and place affect Michelle Schacht? How does what at 2017 and the vibe that you get touring the country and being in Scotland at the Fringe Festival, how does that affect and inform your fight? Does it change the way, I mean, are you the kind of artist and activist that goes with what's happening now, or are you true to what your ideals are no matter the change of course?
It's, again, a beautiful, soulful question, and I'm starting to float off into the stratosphere with you, so you got to get me back down on the ground just. I really am compelled by the zeitgeist, you know, as a poet, as, you know, a kind of homespun philosopher. You can't put yourself in the crosshairs of it, but I just had an amazing experience on the cab ride over here with this cab driver who apparently you interviewed 20 years ago.
You told me that. I can't believe it. I know exactly what you're talking about.
He plays a shakuhachi.
He plays a flute in his cab.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know what it was called.
Only taxi driver, he says, who appreciates a red light. And... And we were really grokking on this. You know, let's just leave it at the simple explanation that poetry is an amazing force. It is an amazing thing because you're plucking out of thin air something that doesn't exist, and then suddenly it exists. So it's probably a better question than my answer, but that's my final answer.
I actually like you out in the space. I don't like putting you back on the ground. Who wants that, right? We got plenty of that. Michelle Schacht, my guest tonight here in The Download. We're talking about her career, but also the singer-songwriter will be on stage at City Winery tomorrow night, playing the entire album Arkansas Traveler as part of a trilogy of shows she's been doing all summer at City Wineries across the country. You know, I think about all the things we're talking about, and it's fascinating to me because you as an artist, you have been able to create a career around these obstacles. Right?
I mean, because in spite of myself.
Well, but in spite of yourself, but also the fights. I mean, because as we began this conversation talking about being blacklisted from the music industry because of your contract that you got with Mercury Records, we've talked about your take on authenticity. We've now talked about, you know, just you know, the idea of your warrior heart, warrior soul, where you're at now, and I find it interesting that. You know, we're at this point with the City Winery show that you are able to tell the story of your career, and yet you still fight. And you know, if I go to your Twitter account, and I did today, and here you are fighting against YouTube, fighting against digital media has replaced the record industry, fighting against people who think it's okay to turn their phone on and take a picture of you or record you live. A lot of things that people don't fight about. Artists don't fight about that stuff. I went and saw Chance the Rapper at Lollapalooza. He says, take out your cell phone. You know, I mean, at a certain point, artists are like, all right, these are fights that I'm not going to take on. I got other things to take on. But you fight it. And you fight it for the good fight because you feel in a certain way that this is copyright and you own it. It's almost like you're fighting Mercury Records your entire life.
I'm going to tweak it just slightly to say I may be ahead of my time, but I'm only like 5 minutes ahead of my time. And the fight that you see me engaged in now, I may be the first artist that you hear explaining this, but I won't be the last. And it's a fight called the Fight for Artist Rights. And the digital technologies have reduced the value of what artists do to the point where it's literally unsustainable. That we're old enough to remember when coffee went almost overnight from 25 cents a cup to $4 a cup because the commodities market had driven down the value of coffee to the point where farmers were coming to market and finding out that they couldn't even get paid what it cost them to grow the beans. And we decided that we liked coffee enough that we were going to jack the price up to pay. Remember, it was called fair trade. And that's the fight for artist rights right now.
Does there need to be artist fair trade?
There absolutely does.
Huh. I mean, but that's interesting because you're seeing more and more young artists accept the realities and say, I'm not going to sell my music because there's nothing to sell. And where am I going to sell it? I'm going to use it as a experience instead. I'm going to, you know, you see that more often. I mean, like I mentioned Chance, but the idea that more and more artists are instead of fighting the system head on, they're finding ways to kind of snake around it.
Well, what you're seeing is the equivalent of that, you know, product placement in the eye level section of the supermarket, the toothpaste that's right there. And what you're not hearing is all of the artists who have given up, who have quit, who have followed other paths because the unsustainability of what used to be a feasible pursuit of a middle class life has now been taken away. And the best case I can make is that we're just the canaries in the coal mine, that the value of labor across the board has been devalued. And that's what, you know, I was talking with my friend, the taxi driver, about. He had some poems about Uber. You know, the gig economy has driven down the value of labor. So I think even though I didn't want to be in the early days a woman who was speaking on behalf of feminist issues, I wanted to use the insights that I had as a woman to talk about racism. I can now justify being an artist fighting the good fight for artist rights because I believe that that's what I have the most experience with. Hmm. And if I can push back in that area, I can stand shoulder to shoulder with other laborers.
Can you win that fight? I mean, do companies like YouTube or Facebook or Twitter or SoundCloud, I mean, Apple, I mean, I name them down and I mean, can you, they seem to on the front when they talk to us consumers seem to consider the artist.
I tell you how I'm going to do it. First, I'm going to take down Google, and then I'm going to take down Amazon. And I've already got the European Union on my side, and I've got Canada on my side. And eventually, this country's going to come around and realize that antitrust must be the thing. It's got to go. That these are monopsonies exercising the same robber baron power that they did at the time that drove us into the Great Depression. It's got to stop. So I've got history on my side.
Yeah, that's amazing passion. And you know, it kind of reminded me of the cover of your album.
Sharp. Bigger they are, the harder they fall.
Well, I mean, there's something great about, I mean, you said at the beginning, you didn't want to necessarily be a famous artist. You wanted to be an activist. And here you are, 30 years into the business, speaking on WGN Radio, talking about activism when it comes to artist rights.
And
so it worked.
And the question is so relevant because we're, you know, dealing with the realities of what's happening with media consolidation, with the, you know, the rightward shift of media. So I'm running for daylight, man, as long as I can talk with this kind of quality of conversation. Thank you, Justin. Thank you so much.
Michelle Schacht is going to be at City Winery in the West Loop tomorrow night as part of the trilogy. She's been there twice already this summer. Tomorrow night, she will be performing the entire record, Arkansas Traveler, 25 years later. It was 1992. Michelle Schacht, singer-songwriter in studio tonight. It is a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming down and talking to us tonight.
You are awesome. Thank you so much.